final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway night, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
name is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
To Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one but three chat rooms and even a cheapo version of a emergency chat room for just such an emergency. The chat room don't work. Anyway, I always start the Mad Science show off with that song High Voltage. I like that. It's got like uplifting, get you ready for some fun kind of music. Anyway,
Hope tap too.
Yeah, gives you something to tap your toe to, listen while you get your coffee, get all excited. The Mad Science show's coming on, and you might hear some craziness and stuff. We try to make it fun here. on the Mad Science Show. Anyway, there's a video that I posted over there that Lidmotor did, and it's a pretty nifty little pulse motor that he put together that runs off a capacitor, and essentially it's got like a little propeller on there with some magnets on the end there, which got me thinking about some things. I also posted a link to surpluscenter.com where there's an electric DC motor which essentially came off of a fitness treadmill. And these are pretty interesting motors. I've got one. I was able to hook a 9-volt battery to this thing, and just a little bitty square 9-volt battery like you'd put in your radio, and this doggone thing will turn. So that shows me it's pretty doggone efficient. Well, the other thing that I like about this particular motor is it's got a flywheel, a weighted flywheel on there. And don't know exactly what the purpose in the treadmill was outside of, you know, the obvious. But these are pretty impressive little motors. And I was able to just spin it over a couple times and get some voltage out of it, so I think this would probably be something that you could actually modify into a wind turbine type generator, you know, and as far as how efficient it would be, you know, run it in the conventional sense as far as charging batteries, it's to be seen because it ain't been done as far as I know. I'm sure there's somebody out there that's built one, but I got other ideas about this thing. I was taking looking at that motor that Lidmotor put together, a little pulse motor, and it's pretty much got like a propeller on there, straight up and down, vertical. And I got to thinking about this thing. if you know anything about leverage, you can lift a lot of weight with leverage.
Oh, yeah.
And if you pay attention to physics and centrifugal force and centrifugal force and all the different forces that you know as far as physics go, you can, well, think about this for a second. You know these little cordless drills they got these days? They got some really good gear ratios in there. And you're able to take anywhere from a 9, well, actually I've seen them as low as 6 volts. 6 volts, probably nickel cadmium batteries inside there. Some of them might be nickel metal hydride. It's hard to say which ones are using in the cordless drills these days.
Mostly lithium these days.
Yeah. Okay, so they got the lithium batteries in there. And these things are able to take this voltage and transfer it into a massive amount of torque, enough torque to either drill a hole through something or even screw into something. And they even got some modern day, the newer ones actually have like a hammer drill portion to them. So that's a lot of power that you're getting off of that amount of energy. It's pretty impressive. I'd say it's kind of efficient, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess what I'm beating around the bush to say here is that knowing leverage and gear ratios and all that kind of stuff, if you took that particular motor right there, that treadmill motor, and you got that thing spun up to some serious RPMs, whatever is rated on that particular motor, once that motor is up and running and that flywheel is spinning around, it has reverse threads on there, so the flywheel ain't going to spin itself off of there as long as you're driving in the right direction. And you get that thing spinning up, centrifugal force to take over and actually help to assist keeping that motor going. Now, one of the friction losses that I see from that particular design would be the fact that there's no bearing in the front to actually, there is inside the motor, but I mean on the outside of the motor to actually help to carry the weight of that flywheel. And so basically you'll get some friction down on the front bearing of that motor, and I could see it actually wearing out after a while. Unless it was setting up, well, even if it was setting up vertical, if it's setting horizontal and that flywheel is spinning around, you're going to get some friction that eventually would wear that bearing down. But if you had a bearing in front to carry some of that weight, once that centrifugal force gets up to spinning, buddy, you know how, like, whenever you you fire up your grinder, you know, table
yeah.
grinder, and when you fire that thing up, it takes a long time for it to wind down?
Yeah, it's because that flywheel's spinning, actually, the motor's spinning many times faster than that flywheel, but the deal is, for that motor to slow down, it's going to take a bit.
Yeah. And,
now, if you multiply the speed of your, let's say your grinding wheel was multiplied in speed, then it would take even longer for it to kind of die down. Because you multiply the torque that can actually be set in something. If you say you tried to use it as some kind of a hammer and it just swung around really, really fast and then it hit something. All of that, it's a multiplication of force.
So what I'm thinking about is, we know that if you take that flywheel, because it's heavy, and you spin it up, it takes a long time, just like a train, it takes a long time for a train to slow down.
Right.
Imagine that motor with Lid Motors' little design that he's got where it's actually got a propeller on there, like a weighted propeller. I don't see that it'd be that hard to actually modify some sort of propeller system that you could actually put some weights into the propeller itself. And so, with that said, if that propeller is straight up and down, it doesn't take much to send it over the edge, and then now you have gravity helping to assist that propeller in bringing that other side of the propeller back up to the top. You see what I'm saying?
Right, store energy and then you use it, and store energy and you use it, and overall it runs a lot smoother because.
Yeah. So, I'd like to see a design put together that actually uses the principles of the stored energy that you talked about, and the way that Lid Motor shows it as using the capacitor to store energy, and so all it has to do is make a little pulse once in a while and help to assist that thing around. When I look at that thing, I actually look at something that could potentially go for a long time, if not indefinitely, if done properly. And when I look at this motor right here, I think about size-wise, if you got that weighted flywheel, that's going to help to assist that thing. Once you get that flywheel up and moving, it's going to help that motor. It's going to take less energy input on that motor to keep that thing going because of that centrifugal force.
Well, I don't quite agree with that. The more weight you got on that flywheel, the more bearing friction you got. The thing is, about a weighted flywheel, it takes longer to get it up to speed, but I tell you what, if you're trying to collect all that energy stored in that flywheel and use it, you can store a lot of energy in that thing. Matter of fact, if you get a drill up to full speed and then just jam it into the wall, that sucker will drill that hole, just like you punched it, and it won't slow it down very much, but
yeah.
Because it's got that torque.
Well, imagine if you could take that flywheel and have its own independent bearing system, all right? And it's still connected to the motor, but it has its own independent bearing system to carry that weight, you know, some carrier bearings or something.
Yeah.
So now that motor bearings, they're going to be all right. All they got to be able to do is get that thing running. Then you throw in the portion that Lid Motor had where it's got like a propeller on there, and these propellers have weighted tips on there. Those will also assist that flywheel.
Yeah.
Because when that weight is up at the top, it doesn't take much. See, that... if that was perfectly balanced, it would want to eventually come to a rest horizontally, if it was perfectly balanced. But in order to get it to come to that, in the meantime, it's going to be using gravity to pull the other side right back up again. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, this is what I've been talking about for a long time, is taking all these things in conjunction with each other. And if the propeller is a lot larger than the motor. That size of that propeller would be able to overcome any drag once you put that thing under a load. You see what I mean?
Oh yeah. Every time you double the size of it, you've got four times the torque of carry. So I mean, yeah, if I put a 10-foot prop on a motor and the wind spins it up and then the wind dives, it's not going to die right away because it's got a lot of circumference and a lot of leverage, and it'll keep on spinning and it's aerodynamic. It'll go around and around. Then when the wind starts to pick up, it catches that point where it catches up with the speed of lift, and that prop won't stall out. That prop will just pick right up right along with it. And every time the wind blows, it'll sit there and generate some more and generate some more. It's getting it up to speed the first time. After that, it'll stay there. It takes a bit to get it up to speed, and I like watching it, you know. I like watching it. You sit there and you watch it. It goes slow, and it goes slow. Then all of a sudden, it takes off, and then the wind dies, and it's still spinning at a decent speed, and the wind will come back, and it'll keep on doing. It'll catch it every time after that, unless the wind dies for, like, more than a minute or so, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the length of a prop is, it carries a lot of weight. Even though you pick up the prop, and I've carved 90% of the wood off, you know, 90% of the weight is not there, but it's the fact that it's so long. It gets up there, you know, like I said, every time you double the length, you got four times the power stored in it as a flywheel. So it'll keep going.
Yeah. Pretty neat. And there's one other thing that...
I could watch that all day, you know. I think I've said that a few times.
Imagine on your propeller, if you had your propeller itself was connected to a centrifugal clutch, to where until it got up to a certain RPMs and centrifugal force kicked in and pushed those clutch pads out and grabbed a hold of the side, just like how they run go-karts and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you took that centrifugal clutch and the weighted flywheel and a prop, the weighted prop with the weighted tips on the end of that, and all these things in combined, what I'm trying to get at is that step by step, using everything from physics, you're bringing this thing up to a higher efficiency by using every bit of leverage or whatever you can, gear ratio and centrifugal force and all that to your advantage. So I can see that you could literally build at the very least, a wind turbine that would be so incredibly efficient. Like the motor.
I'm glad you brought that up, because here's the funny thing about it. If you had a regular old permanent magnet motor that's, you know, it's got steel inside the coils and stuff like that, they're only 45% efficiency, all because of that, and it has drag and lens losses and all that stuff. But when you go to the axial flux, it basically doesn't have any drag, and it's the same as having a clutch, because it's not going to, let's just say the RPMs is the voltage, okay? And when it gets up to when it spins up to that certain RPM that equals the voltage, where if the batteries were charged a little higher, it would take a few more RPMs to reach that. It spins as free as a bicycle wheel.
Yeah, that's...
It's when the wind tries to push that blade faster than those RPMs, and the battery is trying to raise that battery voltage, that's when the amps flow. So the torque, the speed is the voltage, and the torque is the amperage.
Well,
if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So it spins like a bicycle wheel until it gets there, and that's one of the things that does make it very efficient and keeps it from stalling out and all that kind of stuff. If it was a regular permanent magnet motor, it'll still have lens drag, and it'll slow down and keep on slowing down and always have drag, and it's not very efficient. It takes away from it, and your blades might have to start all up again.
Well, I want to jump back on that bicycle wheel you just mentioned there a second ago, because there's two different types of bikes that I know of that actually have a, what they call a freewheeling bearing system in there. One be like your 10-speed bike, you know, how you can pedal those backwards when you're going forward. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And the other one would be like the old freestyling bikes, pretty much the same system. It's not like the solid shaft where you have to fight with your legs, and if you get going, let's say, 40 miles an hour down the hill, and your legs are like really going, it'll drive you nuts and wear your legs out and that kind of stuff, trying to keep up with the pedals. But the freewheel design will allow you to move forward without having to sit there and fight that resistance, which would also be slowing you down. That's why a 10-speed bike goes so much faster.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking, this is how I look at everything out there. All the mechanical potentials of like everything from bicycles to treadmills to leverage, Raymond's old two-stage oscillator that he had, where you can lift a lot of weight with a little bit of effort from the other end using leverage and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, if we took and put together a design, it could be with all existing parts from everything that we know of, and every weak spot that would literally build up friction, like, for example, what we mentioned earlier about the flywheel. A flywheel, because of its weight, is obviously going to put more friction on bearings. Now, if you had its own independent bearing system that would carry the weight of that flywheel, and that independent bearing system was, you know, well lubricated or kept cool so that it couldn't damage the bearings in there, and it could withstand the speed, because once it gets going, you know, it's going to build up even more friction. See, this is where we fight with everything. It don't matter whether it's electronics or whatever. It's always the losses that are occurred be due to friction and heat. And where heat is normally the bad thing, which is what I'm trying to get to the end of this example of by taking the motor and putting the flywheel on its own independent bearing, having a weighted prop that will use, so we're using centrifugal force on the one, we're using gravity and centrifugal force on the second, and, you know, maybe even a centrifugal clutch or even the design, you know, until that motor gets up to a certain speed, it doesn't even start to try to turn anything. So when you spin that motor up, once it gets up to a fast enough speed where it can literally start to kick and engage the centrifugal clutch, now that sudden jolt is the first turn necessary to get that flywheel to begin.
Right.
Yeah.
You're talking on the dual-stage oscillator, right?
Yeah. So once it builds up that momentum can actually kick it right over the hill, get it started, then the centrifugal force of the weighted flywheel will begin to assist that and make it less have to work hard, less as, where it doesn't have to work as hard to get going. Then the same process goes for the weighted propeller that does the same thing, and it using gravity as well, and so on down the line. So once it gets to the end of this whole process, to your generating head that you're going to be using to turn to get your electricity, the moment you put a light bulb on, now you'd have to fight with Lenz's law again. You see what I mean?
Exactly. And one of the problems Boom Boom had on his dual stage oscillator, trying to hook it up to a generator, which was never wholly successful, was the fact that each time it had to start that, it had to nudge that that generator into motion, and because it wasn't an axial flux or air core permanent magnet, it had steel in there, it would spin just a bit and stop, and each time it would hit it, it darn near bust the chain, because that's a lot of energy going into it.
Yep.
So the main thing that I proposed, and I hope when I start going back up there again, which shouldn't be that much longer, is we're going to go up there and go with the plan that we had all along for a while. It was actually just pump water up and let the weight drive it, and it wouldn't be in surge. It would smooth it out more like a flywheel does, being in a it would have power all the time. If it's not enough, then that's okay. You know, we'll just gear it a little different and see if we can get, see what kind of voltage and what we can get out of it. and compare it to what goes in. And we can, being an axial flux being 97% efficient, I'm thinking, you know, with pumping the water up there, he said he can get that water up there about 20 foot, and, so much of it each time, and it would be enough to sit there, and if it was in something that just, that was geared up to spin the rotor, which is pretty heavy and can actually store, it would stay running pretty smooth, and the constant weight of water coming down on it, it wouldn't be in surges and wasted power. It would be pretty efficient. We could actually calculate power in and power out and get some actual notes and everything to put on there, because I do believe he's got a hold of free energy.
Well, I believe so, too.
Over unity. Let's put it that way. I'm sorry.
I believe so, too, and I believe that now once we get it down to the point where you're starting to pull power off of your generator head, now we need to reconsider on how we're actually going to pull that power off and use it. All right? I've been talking about plasma technology a lot because science says light is heat and heat is light, vice versa. Alright, well, you're getting a two-for-one kind of thing there. Normally, waste energy is in the form of heat. Heat and friction losses. And so, what's to stop you from pulling that energy off, which means that you don't have a direct path for the electrons to flow back in there and begin to invoke Lenz's law. And even if you was to invoke Lenz's law to some extent, it'd be the equivalence of an LED being lit up as opposed to a tungsten element incandescent light bulb being lit up. You see what I mean?
Yeah. The Lenz law that you want is actually, if you get off, if you're going to have Lenz law because you're generating, okay? You just don't want to be generating Lenz power into a shorted piece of metal. All the Lenz effect you want should be generating electricity and going into the batteries. That's all the Lenz that you want, and you'll actually feel cogging, and that's good cogging instead of the bad cogging.
Well, I think we can do it without the cogging. I think we can actually change that energy to a completely different form of energy. And
well, I hear that from a lot of people, but when I actually go down and study it, when they find, when it starts generating electricity, that's okay, it's got a voltage. Electricity doesn't have to be flowing, it can be a voltage, but it doesn't do anything until it's flowing. But here's the deal, when these people that say they have eliminated the cogging, then why, when you drain any power or it starts putting into the batteries, can you hear the magnets passing? Because it is cogging. It's a generative cogging. And, you know, cogging is, to explain to somebody what cogging is, because not everybody knows it, cogging is when the magnet passes the metal in the coil, and it wants to stay at that coil, so you'll hear a vibration as it passes. On an axial flux, you don't have that. And therefore, it doesn't need a certain amount of wind to get the prop to start moving, to get it over, kind of like a bicycle going up a hill and back down it. The deal is, there is no drag at all from cogging until it reaches the battery voltage, until the RPMs reach the battery voltage. And then you have that. And those ones that say they have no cogging, you can hear it. And it's still there.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that what normally would have been the wasted energy would be actually where you're going to be pulling your power. And the
Well, yeah. Let me straighten out the point here. What most people say is they've eliminated the cogging. That's only startup cogging.
Well,
in other words, it does. You know, when that blade stops, it doesn't want to go to one position where a magnet is over the metal of a coil.
Yeah, and I'm not trying.
It's all slanted. It still generates and does that, and it still cogs, and you can hear it when it's generating. When it's actually running some amps. Other than that, the startup cogging has gone away, and that's a good thing, because that means you don't need a certain amount of wind to actually get the blade started.
I'm not trying to defy...
That is a wonderful thing.
I'm not trying to defy any of the known laws of physics. What basically what I'm trying to do is bring it to a point where it's so incredibly super efficient. Like I can generate plasma using a transistor. All right, a transistor and some capacitors, and I can generate plasma, you know, with anywhere from 400 volts and up. Might even be less that. But it's real simple. And if I can see that visible light there, then there's heat involved with it. And so, just like the old mercury arc rectifier, I can imagine that back in the day when they fired that thing up at first, it was like a dead short, you know. But it probably didn't last very long, because once that dead short heated that mercury up past its thermal breakdown and basically vaporized it into gas, and that energy still coming in, that's how they were able to turn it into plasma and rectify that DC current and still have enough power on the outside of that thing to run those old DC elevator motors. So that's some pretty impressive technology. Now, had that have been hooked direct to, like, let's say, your normal bridge rectifier,
right,
that generator would have bogged down so hard. The more you pulled power off of it, the harder it would have bogged down. And, of course, once you pull power and that bogs down, then that means there's going to be some heat buildup somewhere, and that's normally going to be right in the rectifier portion of it, and it's going to cause that thing to fail. Huh?
And in the coil.
Yeah, and in the coil. The coils will get
wherever the highest resistance is or more current flows.
So if your driving force is an electric motor, then the key to that would be to reduce that effect so that it doesn't build up those the resistance in the coil and cause it to get hot. So the motor, we can protect this motor, and we can protect the bearings using physics already. So we know we can get this motor to be able to run and get up to its maximum RPMs and maximum amount of torque, you know, running at normal, and as long as we're not putting that thing under a load, then that thing's not going to get so hot that it's either going to be less efficient or it's going to be burning itself up, you know, finally meeting the thermal breakdown of the insulation and destroying itself. That's how right. Motors fail. So, if we got this thing, it doesn't matter what generator head you got. Regardless of whether you got it under a load, it's still producing that energy, and that energy wants to go somewhere. And if it's just sitting there freewheeling, it's not going to get hot. The energy's just, bouncing around. The only way to get hot, you know, run it for hours on time, or you're getting it up to such extreme RPMs that energy's literally backing up in them coils.
And so you get the hysteresis, yeah. So you start using amps until it blows. Pressure doesn't mean anything. Right.
But the frequency at what that energy is being built up in that coil wants to go somewhere. And one thing about high voltage is it's not particular. It doesn't like it doesn't like to stay. It'll cross everything. It'll go through insulation, because of the rate at which it's going and the high voltage and the pressure built up.
And right, so, just like a pipe, you put enough pressure in it, it's going to break out.
Yeah, so guiding that into a chamber that is, filled up with gas or something like that, that's going to energize those molecules inside there and begin to, energize it to the fourth state of matter, being plasma. And so now you got pressure buildup. So your reactor system is like a storage unit of pressure. It's like blowing up a balloon. You know, that power's got to go somewhere. If you just keep on pumping it in there, eventually the heat get hot enough or the pressure get hot enough, something's got to give. So as long as you keep that flowing, such as whenever they were running the elevator motors, then you don't ever have to worry about it overpressurizing, as long as somebody's using the energy down the line. So, I'm thinking by taking everything that we know from physics, taking everything that we know about electricity and mechanical and all this kind of stuff, and putting it all together, changing that energy so that from start to finish, the generator, the initial driving force, which would have been the electric motor, transfers its energy over to a flywheel system, which in turn transfers its energy into the propeller system, the weighted propeller. And at each stage of the game, you're using something that physics already has to offer, you know, what goes up must come down kind of thing. You know, the force of gravity, and taking everything that would have normally been resistance and turning it into a plus. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So you start pulling that energy off of it in a completely different matter, and none of that energy can feed back the other direction to start to overwhelm the deal. Let's say the electric motor is rated at 3,500 RPM. You never exceed 3,500 RPM, and it say it's got a maximum of 1.5 horsepower at 3,500 RPM. So as long as you're not trying to pull off more than that thing is designed to do, then you'll keep it maintained to where its friction losses are going to be a whole lot less. You see what I mean?
Right, well, yeah, it's not going to turn it all into heat.
Yeah.
Same thing with the wind turbine.
So,
basically, you know, you talk about the flywheel effect of the blades. Well, you know, if you got metal in the inside of your cores, each time the wind passes one, it gets attracted to that thing, and then at that energy stored into the prop, and it'll go past the next one, and it'll go. And it's just like taking a bicycle up and down. If you start take a bike to the top of a hill, you ride to the bottom and you get some speed up, you can get up the other side pretty easy. But if you try starting at the bottom, it's going to be pretty hard.
Yeah, and the thing
you
about
don't
that,
have any stored energy. But when you go to them, axial fluxes, there's none of that. The only stored energy use off of the prop is when the wind dies down. It just kind of keeps spinning. And it has nothing, the lens losses and every, or cogging and all that stuff is not there, so it doesn't use it like a flywheel, except just to keep it spinning up to RPM so when the wind picks up again, it keeps going.
Yeah. And the thing about that blade is, because it's just straight up and down, it's not like a circular disc like the actual metal flywheel. We're using the metal flywheel only for the centrifugal force portion of it. And even though there's probably some gravitational effects involved with it, that's not its main purpose. I see the blade as being the portion where we're actually going to utilize the gravity, because if you didn't have that blade on a shaft to where that energy could be guided where you want it to go, which is around in a circle essentially, then you throw it up in the air and nature's going to balance it back out, and it's going to land flat, horizontal on the ground. It might bounce around for a bit, but eventually it's going to come to rest on flat on the ground. And so even if it's on a shaft, if they're perfectly balanced, at some point it should come to rest like a teeter-totter. You see
right.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But because of the centrifugal force of the flywheel and the
momentum.
Yeah, the momentum of what's going on in the propeller, each step doesn't give the other step time to stop. You see what I mean? Flywheel's trying to wind itself down, finally come to rest after, you know, it finally winds itself down because whatever drag is on it. Meanwhile, you've got the next stage in line that's actually pulling against that to keep it going. You see what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, I got an example for you, and I'm pretty sure everybody will grasp it. We took a 3.5 horsepower Briggs & Stratton. And you'll figure out, man, and I've seen it on a video as well, and that's what made me try it, is you can take that, while you're bringing that piston up, it goes up most of the way, and while you've got your finger on that valve, you can rotate that valve. It's not completely closed, the intake valve and the exhaust. and it only does that in the last inch or so. And that's kind of stupid. So we took a 16th of an inch off of each of those valve rods and then polished them and then set them back in. And basically, we, you know, friend came over and got it, and he said he couldn't get it started. I said, well, put the doggone lawnmower blade on the sucker. And once he put the lawnmower blade on it, he had enough flywheel effect to get that thing through the compression stroke, and it ran like a top. But without it, it wouldn't run, because it didn't have enough energy stored in that little flywheel that the magneto's on. So, more flywheel was the main deal that kept that thing from running. It was harder to pull. It used more gas, but it had the same effect as a 10 horsepower lawnmower. And that's the cool thing about it, with that extra compression on, you know, being able to go into it.
Well, if you look at the actual lawnmower or any internal combustion engine, for that matter, they all have a flywheel on there.
Right.
Because that
flywheel, some of them will not run.
Yeah, they're trying to use...
Especially once you beef them up.
They're trying to use the centrifugal force to literally overcome the compression that it takes to actually, you know, when that piston's going up, it's actually meeting resistance, which is creating the compression. And without that flywheel, you wouldn't have enough power to keep that thing going around long enough to go past that compression stroke and then for the ignition to be able to slam that piston back down, starting the process over again. So essentially what's going on in the motor is what we're talking about here today.
In the engine, yeah.
Yeah, in the engine. So you're going to use things to overcome that initial pressure or whatever force that you've got to go against, even the cogging effect. Yeah, I believe we could even get past any cogging effect on a standard style generator just by increasing the size of that flywheel alone, the weight of that. Once you get that thing started, it's going to have more power stored in that flywheel than the resistance on the opposite side. You see what I mean?
Right.
Like, if you look at this picture, I posted a picture of the actual generator inside the chat room. Or the generator, the electric motor that out of the treadmill. If you actually look at that, the flywheel is substantially larger than the actual motor itself.
I'll be right back. I think I have company.
Okay. And so, looking at that, then that flywheel has enough mass to overcome any drag on that whenever it's running. And once it gets it spinning good, going up there real good, gets up to its RPMs, which I don't see on there what the actual RPM maximum is on there. Once it gets going, it doesn't take near the input in order to keep the thing going. That's the whole key right there. Let's see here. 130 volts DC. That thing will go up to 100. It's like 2 point some odd horsepower, look like. Anyway, using some basic physics, basic science, and everything we know about mechanics and resistance and all that, I think that properly engineered, you could literally take these things to an amazing amount of efficiency. Potentially to over unity. Because nature is always going to want to try to balance itself out. That's in everything. Mechanics, you know, you got to have things made precision, because otherwise you get like a flywheel that's off balance, and once it gets up to speed, the faster it gets going, the more off balance it becomes, and it will literally start to produce a vibration that eventually, that vibration will finally, something's got to give. It'll break. It'll tear the weakest point up, which nine times out of ten is the bearings and something like that. How you doing, Thomas? We're live.
You're live?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're not, none of you are zombies.
Yeah, we're not zombies today. So anyway, if the flywheel is completely off balance, then once you get that thing going, it's going to produce such a vibration that it'll literally start to tear things up. That's why everything has to be made precision in your automobile. Otherwise, if you got anything in your automobile that's vibrating, then something ain't engineered properly. You should be able to engineer an engine that would do everything that you want it to do that wouldn't vibrate. Now,
right. That's
some extreme engineering, and it can be done. I mean, it's been done. If you look at a computer hard drive, the precision bearings in them are so incredible because the RPMs of that disc spinning around and everything, it has to be perfect. Because if those little arms are, you know, dragging on things because maybe something's not perfectly balanced in there, and so every so often you get this catch on there, it won't take long, that hard drive will fail. But those things usually last for quite a long time until, you know, either something thermally breaks down or whatever. But nonetheless, they're precisionally milled to, you know, really tight specs where these things will spin freely, really easy. And this is what I'm talking about. If you could actually take the time to mill at these things and machine them, everything, and use everything you know, such as the weighted flywheel being on its own bearing system and those bearing systems being more than what they actually need to hold the weight up, you know, so that it's never going to reach its thermal breakdown. And if you can keep those bearings cool and they can never reach their thermal breakdown, then those bearings won't never fail. And as long as the flywheel is perfectly balanced, then you won't develop any vibrations. As long as you don't exceed whatever RPMs you decided at the beginning that you was going to run this thing at, then it would never fail. Meanwhile, the driver force, which would be the electric motor at the beginning, it would not have to work any harder than it was supposed to be designed to, and as long as the windings inside there never reached their thermal breakdown, then the motor itself would never fail. Even magnets have a thermal breakdown to where they'll start to lose their magnetism. See, that's the thing about heat is, to lot, it is probably the worst part of the whole deal. You want to try to avoid heat, you want to try to avoid friction, and what I'm saying is essentially we're taking and turning a lot of this stuff upside down, and now heat becomes your energy source out the other end. And so if you're taking what normally would have been waste, I mean, the internal combustion engine to me is so incredible because this thing will literally get so hot that it will destroy that motor. If it wasn't for the cooling system on there, you know, and airflow going across, or the oil, the viscosity of the oil being just right, and the temperature of the oil being just right, that engine generates so much waste heat that it will literally destroy itself. Now, if instead of designing the engine the way that it was designed to where it even had any kind of remote vibration in it at all, that would be the first thing. If I was the engineer of that engine, I would try to find out where any potential vibration would come from and put a resolution in there so that we could bring the thing down to such an incredible efficiency that when that motor is running, you could put your hand down on there and you wouldn't feel no vibration on it. That's how smooth.
It reminds me of one of the Stirling engines I made, or Stirling motors, I'd have to call it, because it's an external heat. Basically, I figured the displacer was pretty heavy. Well, the piston was nothing but a diaphragm, so it didn't weigh anything. But the displacer had some weight to it. So I let the displacer go all the way down to the bottom, let it rest, and I put a penny on the other side of the flywheel. Well, when we started the thing up, it started up easier. But then when it started running, that thing was all over the table, man, because when the weight got to one side, it'd jerk it one way, and when it got to the other side, it'd jerk it the other way.
Yep.
So instead of just adding a counterweight, I took that penny off there and I added a few more CDs for a flywheel. and it ran much smoother after that. But putting a counterweight on some things when on a single piston, the main thing is it's gonna throw that thing left and right and stuff like, man, that thing walked all over the doggone table.
Oh yeah.
Had to hold it down while it was running, and that was a pain in the wazoo.
Did you look at this all your engines have to have motor mounts to them. If that motor mount didn't have rubber involved in there, the vibration of that engine would just break those mounts. And, you know...
And you got to have them counterweights on them pistons, because you're running some RPMs, and that's a lot of weight, and you don't want to be snapping your crank.
Yeah, and the drive shafts, CV joints and stuff like that on there, same thing. Those things have to be balanced, otherwise when you get them up to the RPMs that basically begin to exceed what that balance would have been. You know, if you're moving slow, don't worry about balance. But if you're going at high speeds, the faster you go and the centrifugal force kicks in, the heaviest portion of that's going to go trying to fly to the outside, and if it ain't got nowhere to go, it'll begin to vibrate until it literally tears itself apart. So we know all this. So if you, like, when you carve those props, buddy, you got to pretty much get them pretty close into both sides weighing the same thing, right?
Oh yeah, I balance them suckers. You got to balance them. If you don't balance them, your machine will tear itself apart.
Yeah, you get some high winds out there, and centrifugal force kicks in, and the heaviest part of that mass wants to pull outward, you know? And when that happens, it starts to vibrate, starts tearing bearings up. So, I believe that if things are properly engineered, and if you use all the laws of physics to your advantage, as opposed to the way it is now, see, sometimes you get to a point where if it's good enough, then that's all you worry about. And in the industry, it'd be all right, because if somebody exceeds what it's supposed to be doing to begin with, then, you know, there ain't no warranty to it, and they can sell more parts that way. But if they really seriously wanted to do it, they could engineer motors and electric motors and gasoline and diesel engines and stuff like that to never break down. I've got a 1951 Massey Ferguson tractor, 70 years old.
Really?
And that thing is still running. 70 years after it was first put out there on the market, because the way that it was crafted together, it's still running. And of course, it's been upkeeped and it's been gone over as far as, you know, rings and ring sleeves and pistons and stuff like that. It's been, you know, redone. But the fact that you can take a 70-year-old machine and do a little bit of work to it, and it's back as good as it was whenever it came off the factory, that's the difference between old school technology and what we do today. I mean, they can make some incredible stuff today, but it seems like
you look at some of that old shop machinery, man. That stuff's got to be moved in with a forklift.
Yeah.
Now what? It's gonna outlast your life. It's good. Of course, it's gonna need maintenance and bearings and little, you know, switches replaced and stuff like that due to contact wear and stuff like that. But it was made to last.
When I was going to college,
I designed a prosthetic arm with 36 stepper motors and all, had the full dexterity of every joint in your hand and wrist and the whole schmear. And worm gears and spring tensions to open your fingers back up and stuff like that. And we got all the way through it, and the robotics instructor said, well, send one part to one company to be manufactured, another part to another one. That way nobody catches on to what you're doing. They're just looking at one part. And then when you get it all back, you put it in, I said, so what are we going to make these parts out of? He said, well, it depends on which part you want to wear out first. I said, I don't want any parts to wear out. This is a prosthetic arm. This guy's going to put it on. You don't want it to fail while he's driving or something like that, you know? Or he gets hurt because he can't use it. And I said, that's not right. And he said, well, then you're not going to make any money. So that's what industry does these days that they didn't do back then.
Yep, things have to fail. I mean, the tractor that I was talking about, the simplicity of the design, easy to maintain, that kind of stuff. Everything's heavy and it's built to last. 70-year-old tractor and it's still running. You know, and so I'm saying modern technology, with the machining skills that we got now, I mean, we can get down to such precision, it's just crazy. And if we could get like the right shop and the right team in that shop and manufacture things to be specifically as precision as possible and take it in effect of what actually burns an electric motor out, you know? Where is its failure point? And fix those failure points. Failure points in electric motor are the insulation on the windings and the bearings. And if you're using brushes, that's an obvious failure point, but that's a failure point where it's a simple fix if you design it right to where you can just, you know, undo a screw and put in a new brush and bam, you're ready to go again. You know, that's the difference.
One of the other differences is everybody wants higher RPM, higher RPM. More heat, more friction, more wear faster. Same as you're moving a piece of sandpaper faster.
Yep.
Now these older engines like the Listers, the old hit and miss motor engines, man, things were a lot lower RPM. They were just a wider piston that had a lot more torque. You know, but you know, like you said, these battery operated electric drills, man, it's real high RPM and geared down before it gets to the drill shaft.
Man, I've looked at some old safes that they had like way back in the 1800s. Some of them might even actually been prior to it, you know, like metal safes. Those doors on those things, still as true as they were the day that they were put together.
Yeah, Boom Boom's got one in his office down there.
Yeah, and so you're able to, if that thing was off the hinge, you're going to have to work hard to open and close that door. But because the way that it's precision put on there, that thing, you just barely, with your fingers, pull it. You don't have to give it any kind of, you know, real tug in order to get the dang thing open. It just open, you know, like a breeze right there.
Kind of like Coral Castle's main huge coral doorway. That thing, it's a revolving stone. And it, you can push it with one finger over, though, even though it's a few tons.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get to. See how that's a great example because, you know, a little kid can go up there and open that doggone door.
Yeah, one man built it. That's the cool thing. You know what they found out? You know, I forget what happened, and basically they wound up having to take that out, and they tried to find out, you know, what was the pivot stone that held all that weight. Come to find out when they tried to make a composite off that thing, it was a meteorite. It wasn't something from this earth. It was just so hard. It had already been baked in some really high temperature.
Well, that's another thing, too, is the way that these...
quality parts.
The bearings are actually made these days. You know, the difference, like in different types of drill bits that, you know, carbon steel and stuff like that. There's some really good drill bits out there. Some of them actually have diamond... tips on them, but
yeah.
the difference of the material, everything's going to break down at its weakest point. And if you know the thermal breakdown of any material, I don't care what it is, you know how far you can actually push that material before it fails. Yeah, now I figure if a guy like me can figure this out, and a guy like you and Thomas can figure it out, then the industry has to know. If you build certain parts out of certain types of metals, you know, like the worst thing for bearings is that they build up moisture and begin to rust or oxidize and then start to fail.
Right.
You got grease in there, that'll buy you some time. But if you're like driving your tractor in and out of the water, swamp, or whatever, eventually it'll build up moisture in there, and there's certain, like brake fluid, it'll actually draw moisture and cause things to rust. So, using everything you already know, you could literally take away, like, you don't have to use brake fluid. regular hydraulic fluid. It doesn't have to be that particular material. You could use some other liquid because the hydraulic pressure is going to work the same,
Yeah, but vice versa on something else, that brake fluid to tear some stuff up, rubber seals.
Yeah.
You get brake fluid on your paint job, you might as well forget about repainting it.
Looks like we lost Thomas.
Oh, my goodness.
So, different materials will react differently with all kinds of stuff, but if you never reach the thermal breakdown of it, or the materials aren't corrosive and so on, you can design the whole doggone engines from start to finish to never fail, man. What do you think?
It would be nice. They don't build them like that anymore. They just don't build them like that anymore. And like I said, we already know the reasons, and they got their reasons. Did you ever notice the newer cars, the parts cost a whole lot more?
Yeah.
And the parts aren't made better. They're made worse.
Yeah, and that, and the way that they build the cars, they pretty much build them in layers. And
yeah, you got to take everything apart to replace something simple now.
Yep.
And a special tool. Yeah, it's called proprietary disassemble.
Well, I think that it's planned obsolescence is the key word that they want these things to fail.
I used to think the Japanese used to make these small cars, put them together where people with American-sized hands couldn't work on them, just out of spite. And when you get in the car, you had to fold your leg up this way to get in and get out. Huh. I think they just made everything small out of spite for payback,
Maybe. But nonetheless, it's still the way that things are engineered to fail. And the materials that they use, we got materials that are so rust resistant that could replace, other things. You want like rubber hoses, you want for flexibility. As long as you maintain that rubber hose, keep a good fresh rubber hose on it, then it won't fail unless you overpressurize it or reaches its thermal breakdown where it begins to fail. So industry has to make money, so they make parts that will fail. It is possible for us to make parts that won't fail. I mean, that tractor that I got is living proof of that, 1951 tractor, and outside of a bit of maintenance and stuff, it's held its own. You see what I mean?
Yeah. I think it was Boomer that told me that nylon bushings are much better than the regular metal bearings. Outlast it, and a lot less friction, and all that kind of stuff.
There's some materials in here like, Stephen Givens posted a deal in there, 600-watt 3D printed haulback array brushless motor. See, that's pretty doggone impressive, man. You can sit there and print out a plastic motor, and a lot of times, a lot of these different plastics that you use, I mean, this has probably got bearings in there, but there are plastics out there that are essentially self-lubricating. So just a tiny bit of oil on there would ensure that it never reached its thermal breakdown.
Right.
That's what the whole deal is, man. The heat is what destroys. Heat.
And I hate plastics, man. But I'll tell you what, there are some plastics that'll outlast the metal.
Yep.
Because they're low friction and stuff.
And as long as they're not being bombarded with UVs and stuff that we know UV will eventually deteriorate rubber and plastic and cause it to get brittle, and nature's going to take back whatever it is that you don't use. And so if you're not maintaining it and protecting it from nature, nature will just ride it back down to the dirt. That's plain and simple.
Yeah, you get a little bit of dirt in there, you just created a sandpaper.
Yeah. Beds itself into plastic, and that harder material is going to wear it out. But we've even got methods by which we can keep any crud from even getting in there. What in the heck is that noise?
On my end?
I don't know. I just heard a high-pitched squeal. Don't know what it was.
This noise?
Yeah, that was it.
Oh, that's my bug zapper. I was getting close to the microphone. I couldn't hear it. Yeah, I was sitting there trying to get this fly off my microphone. Every time I start to talk, he wanted to play with my lip.
Well, I think there's something completely different going on with what we call electricity. And I don't think it's actually occurring the way that science says it is, but nonetheless, until you actually, everything's theoretical, until you actually get down to where you can demonstrate what it is that talking about, then it's almost impossible to try to explain to somebody what's actually occurring there. But we know all these different laws of physics. We know where basically science and mechanics has come to an understanding that if you exceed certain points, things break. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the longer we know that, and we engineer with that in mind, man, these 3D printers, and looking at that doggone motor, we got the capabilities and the computer power to literally design stuff out of plastic that will last a long time. And using the same things we've been talking about all the way through this show, you could get these things to be incredibly efficient. With no losses, you know? You said
yeah,
something
efficiency earlier. Efficiency costs more money. Most of the stuff today. Look, now I looked at a generator called the Tailgater from Harbor Freight.
Yeah.
That thing was like a $200 generator, and it's a two-stroke motor. You know, so it hits on every beat of the piston, and it's real small, and it's a let's see here. Let's get the facts straight. This is pretty interesting. It's pretty, and it demonstrates exactly what industry does. I got to put on my boomer glasses here to read this. So give me just a moment to get set for it. There it is. And let's get my glasses. Remember, I said 1 horsepower, 746 watts. Okay. There we go. Now this says it's a 2 horsepower, 63 cc, two cycle gas generator. 900 watts peak, 700 running watts. Well, 700 is just under 1 horsepower. So I can automatically tell you that that permanent magnet motor inside there that is being used as a generator has steel inside the coils. Because once you put steel, even rolled, cold rolled steel inside there to guide the magnetism through, you automatically go down to 45% efficiency. And this figures out exactly to that. 2 horsepower for 700 running watts. Makes sense. Because that would be 1500 watts if it was 100% efficient. Maybe 95% efficient would be 1400.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, you figure it out, 700 running watts, 2 horsepower. But does industry care to make you an efficient motor?
Nope.
No, because it costs more money. They'd rather let you burn more gas to get your efficiency out.
Well, two things here.
Or get your wattage out that you want.
One,
so cost is all on you, not them.
One is a question
that's
for you.
Point.
Two things. One is a question for you.
But that's $88.88, people, at Harbor Freight. I'll lay off that.
When we say horsepower, are we saying that, like, an electric motor that is rated at 1 horsepower is the equivalent of what kind of pull power?
746 watts.
Yeah, is that the equivalent of what an actual horse can pull?
It's equivalent to the work that a horse can do, yes.
Okay.
What they used to rate in horsepower was how much weight you could lift how high in a certain amount of time, and that would be a horsepower. And now they call it torque, but you know what? Torque can be like on a torque wrench. It's not moving.
Okay, so now...
I don't agree with the torque conversions, but unless, you know, when you're going down the road and you got torque to your rear wheels at a certain amount of speed, you know, that's different. And you're going to find out in a car that only 5% of that energy that's being blown up inside the piston is actually reaching your rear wheels.
Yeah, and so
all the frictions and gearing and all that kind of stuff.
So with that said, you mentioned earlier that there was only once you got the magnets and the core on there, then you automatically dropped it down to 45%. Is that what you said?
Yep. As soon as you fill out them coils with any kind of conductive metal, or that shorts out magnetism.
All right, now that's going to bring me to my next point right there, is that these 3D printed motors are printing the housings with plastic, and I see that that would be a plus as far as that motor being able to run more efficiently because it doesn't have that extra drag of that metal housing, which, believe it or not, actually causes losses.
Probably, as long as you don't have to wrap your coils around some kind of metal.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think it's possible to actually build an electric motor that basically takes all that laminate core away and uses just the force of the magnetism inside the magnets. Your actual flux, I believe the reason why that thing's more efficient is because the way that it's designed, it's focusing that energy that you want to take from it inward. In towards the coil system.
Right. It's stretching the magnetic flux between two magnet rotors or two magnet positions right through the middle of the coil. It's like stretching it like a rubber band. It's not going to fold. It's not going to bend. It's directed directly through the air core coil.
Cool. That's what I'm talking about. Focused energy is the key to perfecting every single electric motor we've got out there and every single internal combustion engine. We could literally...
I'm not going to say that the axial flux is the only one that does it. Now, not your treadmill motors, but ones that look almost like it. And they're permanent magnet rotors, motors, but they're 97% efficient as well. The tape drive motors.
Yeah.
The old surplus tape drive motors.
Well, these are all pluses that, you know, people would actually have access to if, you know, like you got a scrap yard nearby where people get tired of their treadmill and throw it off in the dump, you know. You can resell.
Well, see, industry doesn't care that when you get on your treadmill how much electricity you're using. Industry doesn't care. But the military, what, you remember them big, look like reel-to-reel tape recorders, they used to put the data on those. That's what these tape drive motors used to go into. They used to run the tape drive.
Yep.
Reel to reel back and forth. They'd spin one way and then spin the other direction. And you got so much heat in them rooms, the military had to care about how much heat was being made and all that stuff. And so they had to go as low power consumption as they can, so they made them things 97% efficient, unlike the treadmill motors. They look pretty much the same, but they're different.
Well, I think that you can take existing equipment if you had the capabilities to modify it and change out different things like bearings or whatever to make the bearings better. You could actually get... There's a lot of aftermarket products out there that come out whenever things are like prone to fail. They will build an aftermarket deal, and I've seen instances where those aftermarket parts outlasted the doggone motor. You know, because the way that they were designed to compensate for a failure point in, you know, a particular product, they were too good.
Well, sometimes it's not because they're too good. It could be because they don't do the job with the same amount of wattage. Let's put it this way. Let's look at the catalytic converters. I used to cut catalytic converters off of junk cars and then turn them in there, and I used to make pretty close to about $500 a day. And you'd have to pay for them, and then you go get your money and collect them. But the deal was, say you'd get a what they call a large foreign, which was one of the ones you really liked, or the ones off the good Jeeps. Now, those things were close to about over $200-$235 is what I'd get for them. But then there was a deal called an aftermarket catalytic converter, or they call them wire catalytic converters, and they weren't near as good because they didn't have all the precious materials in there, and they didn't do the job that the other ones did, but they were only worth $7.50.
Well, yeah, they also...
Because the precious metal, the variation, or the range of various precious metals in there that did all the catalytic converting was not there.
There are exceptions to the rule as far as aftermarket parts. You can buy aftermarket parts that look like the same thing, but they're not made of as quality of material, so they cost less. But
right.
What I'm
those
saying...
Things without, those things would outlast the other ones. As a matter of fact, if they had a flood... See, if you have a flood and you got a catalytic converter, don't let the water go up the tailpipe and get to that catalytic converter. It'll be ruined, it'll be clogged, and you got to take it, you know, and you got to get another one. That's going to cost you some bucks. The aftermarket ones were cheap enough where people could actually, you know, because you try to replace a doggone catalytic converter from the factory, what's supposed to be in it. Let's get away from the scrap price that I used to get for them. When you try to buy them things, you're looking $700-$800. Most of the time, your car didn't cost that much because you bought it out of the paper, you know. So, but that cheapo catalytic converter, cheapo wire one, that's a different deal. But you let that water get up your tailpipe, it's ruined. You got to replace it. But the wire ones, they'd outlast it. Just start your car up and blow all that water out of your exhaust system, and it'll keep on ticking. So, sometimes they'll last longer because they are cheaper, or just tougher.
Yeah. Well, anyway, by rethinking on how we do things and how we utilize physics and science, we could actually build perfect machines. I'm 150,000% convinced of that. There's no ifs, ands, or buts.
I definitely agree with you.
And so, I think that... You know, I find these little motors like this every once in a while and, you know, do a little test on them. I was able to turn this thing over with a little 9-volt battery. That's pretty impressive because I'm always trying to see how little of an energy input, the least amount of energy input will actually get this thing moving. That's what I want to know. And in the process of this thing running, where are all the energy losses at? You know, where's the friction? Where's the heat buildup and all that kind of stuff? And where in these parts can any of this energy actually be reclaimed? The way I see the internal combustion engine, if you turn that internal combustion engine into a focused heat engine and only allow heat to build up where you want it to be, you wouldn't have an engine that would fail. Period. As long as you never reach the thermal breakdown of any material, it will never fail. You know, two pieces of glass rubbing across each other, properly lubricated, running at extreme RPMs, they'll never start tearing into each other because it'll never get up to that point when that friction gets hot enough to start softening up that glass and allow things to shatter. Or, you know, a lot of times there's actually YouTube videos out there where you can cut glass using heat and cold.
Cold is an enemy too.
Yeah. So the forces...
Just like in some of your light bulbs, man, turn it on and turn it off, turn it on and turn it off, you're going to wear it out a lot faster than if you just left it on.
Yeah. Not to mention, you get that, every time you turn a light bulb on, you get that sudden spike of energy, which for a brief incidence would make your meter spin a little faster. So by
first, you have people where doggone the thermostat goes out in their truck. So they take the thermostat out and just run the car cold. Well, that engine ain't going to last a year. Because running an engine cold is gonna wear it out. It's gotta get up to a temperature where that oil flows right.
Yeah.
And you're not scraping you know, cold metal. Warm metal is more malleable and it just doesn't tear up as fast.
Well, for an emergency purpose, that would be a good thing for short term, like if you just had to get home and the thermostat was seized and you didn't have one.
Yeah, piece of cardboard in front of your radiator there to across part of your radiator there until you get your temperature regulated, at least.
Yeah, well, that would be in the cold, but as far as heat-wise, if it's overheating because the thermostat's stuck, then you'd want to take that thing out of the way until you got home long enough to get to put a new thermostat in there, but to continuously drive with the thermostat out, that wouldn't be a good idea.
You ever look at the, your truck drivers out there, and you look at the front of the rig, and they got these tarps on the very front of the deal there, and they got different, you know, and they got snaps on them so you can snap, unsnap so much.
Yep.
Because wintertime, they've got to cover that radiator because that, you know, a cold diesel engine will break a crank in a heartbeat.
Well,
it needs to be a certain temperature so that combustion kicks. If you try to start one of them big diesel rigs here, and just as it starts to fire, you let off that starter and that thing gets a half kick, you just busted your crank. You need a new motor.
Well, not to mention that if the
once it's warmed up, that's fine. That's a different story, you know.
The heating system.
That's why you see all them snaps in that tarp on the front on those to regulate temperature. The trucker's got to figure that stuff out. For going through mountains where it's cold and different temperature ranges and stuff makes it a lot of difference.
Not to mention the heating portion of the truck. You'll never get the heat up hot enough to. If you're lucky, defrost the windows because the trucks have huge radiator cores in there in order to keep it cool during the summertime. But that's a negative in the winter because now it's too much cooling and it, like you just said, caused problems with the engine. But it also make it where you'll freeze your booty off trying to go to and fro because you can't get the dang thing up to temperature.
That is correct.
Yeah.
100% correct.
So, there's ways that we can use all these different effects, and you know, just your in your house, you got a refrigerator that on the back of that refrigerator has a deal to a heat exchanger that you know takes away some of that heat from your refrigerator. Well, in the process of doing that, if you got your air conditioner running, now your air conditioners have to compensate for that extra heat that the refrigerator's putting.
Or so, if you put that refrigerator right up against the wall and doesn't allow airflow back there, your refrigerator's going to run forever and it's not getting cooled right.
Yeah. So if you modified that your living space to literally have that. That refrigerator be able to be vented outside, you know, not actually sitting outside, but maybe in its own duct system so that during the wintertime you can close it and during the summertime you can open it, you know.
Yeah, the same as a heat pump on a house,
yeah,
correct.
You could utilize that waste heat, you know. And that's another thing. That's a whole thing. It's trying to bring things to its maximum efficiency. If you're trying to heat or cool your house and the doggone refrigerator is heating your house at the same time, it's counterproductive.
Right.
You know? But there's a lot of different things where you could actually, you know, recapture some of that waste heat. You know, the Peltier elements. I ain't ever seen nobody talking about putting Peltier elements on the back of your refrigerator, the heat exchanger back there. And then actually doing the same thing as that we just mentioned about putting it in its own ventilation system so that the heat could be diverted outside in the summer and inside during the winter, vice versa. Now you'd also have that temperature difference in those Peltier elements, which would produce electricity. You could charge batteries using your refrigerator.
Yep.
The back of those things get pretty warm, man.
And yeah, they do.
If you look at every single air conditioner on every single house, during the summertime, you got a whole bunch of water that's built up. The temperature difference outside, the temperature difference on the inside is producing condensation, pulling moisture right out of the air, just like a doggone what do you call those things?
Dehumidifier.
Yeah, dehumidifier. So, at the very least, we could show people how to make their houses so incredibly energy efficient that it'd be ridiculous. And we could actually fix it so that your house would it hardly use any power. You know,
take your dryer, that flexible dryer duct, instead of putting it straight outside. Take that thing up, make you a big spiral on the wall of it, let it run through.
Yeah. Capture some radiant heat out of it.
A dryer will heat your house quick.
Yeah.
Except you don't want all that moisture in there. But they do have, and you can buy them on the market and everything, for the internal venting of a dryer. And basically, I mean, it's nothing but a big filter sack. Might as well be a huge vacuum cleaner bag type deal. It lets the air go through it, and the moisture comes in. And, you know, and they do that for, like, apartments and condos where you can't drill a hole through the wall for it. You know, where an electric, you know, just... But, yeah, why waste that heat? That is a lot of heat, man. You're looking at 3,600 watts minimum on a dryer. And, you know, your space heaters are only 1,500 watts. That's less than half of what your dryer does. So, heck, you're going to be drying clothes all day, and you got to be freezing because you're pumping it all outside. On top of that, your dryer is sucking in new air. So where does that air come from? It comes from the room where your heated air already is. And that gets replaced by outside cold air that comes in to replace it. So you're just dragging in cold air, and you're freezing your butt, and you're putting all your heat outside. Why do that? You can take, matter of fact, I took one of them large soup cans, you know, almost like a coffee can. I stuck that in the neck of a T-shirt, and then I stuck the other neck of another T-shirt on it, and I put a tie wrap around both of them. That way it'd have a 6-inch duct between them. I tied the sleeves and the bottom of the other T-shirt up, and the one T-shirt basically took that to the dryer hose. I would collect the lint and let the air go through and all that stuff and collect some of the moisture, but I tell you what, I mean, you get a little bit of moisture on your windows, you'd see that and stuff like that, and you'd feel the humidity. But, you know, heck, you were warm. So you dry your clothes at night, and then when your clothes are dry, it's pumping dry air after that, and that T-shirt dries out and all that other stuff there. Ever so many loads there, you go ahead and you turn them T-shirts inside out, and hit them with the vacuum cleaner, and go wash them and stick them on there. You gotta, if you don't do that, then you restrict the flow and you start blowing your heater elements.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, hey, the industry actually makes the stuff for the home for the internal venting of dryers, and you could do it that way and save yourself a lot of electricity. A lot of heat and electricity for your house and lower your bill drastically, and it's not that much trouble to just wash a couple T-shirts.
Well, I believe that you could turn every single house out there into a perfect heat engine. I believe you can turn any electric motor or any internal combustion engine into a perfect heat engine, because it's a common denominator for everything out there. I don't care what it is. Every piece of equipment you got, including your house, heat and cold is the common denominator for every single one of them. And heat and cold will, you know, cold will contract, right, and heat will expand, and the expansion and contraction of things is what causes things to break. When they reach the thermal breakdown from the heat, or they reach their limitations of the cold, things fall apart. But you could design your house to where, just like, look at the igloo cooler, man. You've got an igloo cooler that has amazing insulation to it. And then some of the old style thermoses that you put your coffee in there, and hours later, coming back and your coffee's still hot or still cold, whatever you put in there. And don't tell the cold joke again. How's the thermos know? All right, but either way, it's reality. You could build a house that it was so well insulated that it would be so incredibly efficient. You could actually take all the things that were normally a negative, like, you know, every roof has to have vents on there. If that roof was completely sealed up, the temperature difference, for one, would cause a moisture buildup inside there that would rot stuff out from the inside and out, and the pressure buildup would literally cause it to blow up like a balloon and pop. Imagine you're...
That's one of the reasons why I was saying get, you know, run a big coil of that vent tubing, you know?
Yeah.
So that way you don't have that moisture. Every time the moisture evaporates off your wall, it does a cooling thing, so... but it the heat is more valuable than it's still not as efficient, but heck, it works.
Well, there's a lot of stored energy in the attic of your house. Have you
right.
been up in the attic during the summertime?
Man, my roof gets up to about 400 and something degrees up there.
Yeah.
I put the thermometer on that tin roof.
The heat radiating off your roof, the heat radiating on the inside of the attic, and the cold down in the cellar. You know, if you took those two forces and you combined them, you could build your own heat pump system that would literally cool your house without even having to have an air conditioner.
You know, I took video and lost the video. I took some PVC and I stuck it at the end of. My roof. I just cut a slot and then clamped it onto my tin roof because it's got them ripples. And my roof would get hot, man. And I put up one of them soaker hoses up there. And then it came off the end there. And I tell you what, now, you want a hot shower and not have to pay for it, and you don't want to sit there and spend a lot of money for a solar hot water heater, I'll tell you what, that water coming off that duct will burn you, and it's got steam, Bubba. You could probably turn on the soaker hose and wait till it gets to the right temperature and wait a few minutes, then sit there and you can go get your shower off the end of that real easy. But that's heat.
Yep.
And it also cools your house and helps your air conditioner and lowers your bill. Rather than costing you money to make hot water, it saves you money to make the hot water that way.
Yep.
And I did make a video and I put the laser thermometer up there. You notice when you first throw water up on your roof, you see steam rising. So, yeah, you're hitting, there's over 200 degrees on your roof. Most of the, if you put water up on your roof and you see steam rising, that means you made it to 200 degrees up there. But that gets washed off there real quick. So, it only takes like 5-10 minutes to bring that temperature back up and that roof would be dry again.
Some houses have automatic vents in them. And, when the heat and the pressure builds up inside there, these little flaps will open up and allow the heat to escape from the attic. Some houses don't. Some houses just have a vent up there that's open constantly, so even during the summertime, nobody ever thinks about going up there and sealing those things off during the winter, and they end up having to pay a higher heating cost because that, you know, basic science. Heat rises and cold air falls.
Yeah, just a vent fan. You can turn on with a manual switch. It'll save you a lot of money.
Yep. You know, those little wind turbines that are up there, when the heat is rising, it's helping to keep those things spinning. That's why on a hot day with no wind, you can still see those things are still turning.
Yeah, them things ain't got no motor on there.
Yep.
Them things are generating, not that they spin on their own. That means you got a good flow coming out.
Well,
but it is a resistance. The only good thing about those things is they keep the water out.
In my Free Thinkers video, you see this thing? I got one of those vents. It's actually on top of a metal box. And that metal box is basically, when it builds up heat inside there, that heat rises and causes that thing to turn.
Right.
And not only that, on a windy day, the wind is turning it. So, you know, you hot or windy or even cold days, that thing turns quite a bit. And that thing, it's still sitting out there to this day. I don't remember when the first video was, but it's been quite a long time. The lights are still on that thing. So, it just shows that if you want, if you really wanted to, you could actually tap into all the energy that's around you, you know. And if you really wanted to make it super efficient, you could figure out ways by which to do more with less. You understand what I'm saying? Just like the water deal that you explained. Ain't nothing more than laying a big old black coiled up garden hose on top of your roof and you got free hot water.
Yeah, that works well too.
And if that free hot water is being circulated down into your hot water heater, your hot water heater has a thermostat on it that will kick on and off depending on the water temperature. If the water temperature never drops below its time for to kick on, your hot water heater will never kick on.
And if you got your thermostat not setting real high on your hot water heater, that saves you a lot.
Yeah.
Because the lower the temperatures, the less heat bleeds off per minute. And the other thing is, if you got that solar hot water heater up here on the top feeding, you feed your cold water to that solar hot water heater, and then you have it going down to your hot water heater. When you use hot water, it's getting replaced and your electricity doesn't turn on. And that is more efficient than having solar panels and running an inverter or running, running your wire straight down into your doggone heater element.
And
because it's basically just, it's taking that 1,000 watts per meter or 1,300 watts per meter and putting it straight into your tank. And so it doesn't have to reheat every time you use hot water.
During the winter time, whenever the sun is not nearly as hot and your roof doesn't get nearly as hot, you still get heat generated during the winter time. I mean, that's why the snow melts off.
And the thing is, your hot water heater doesn't have to work as hard because it doesn't have to heat the water up as much.
Worst case scenario, when on the cloudy, when the cloudy days and it's really super cold out there, you'd have to, drain the water out of the thing, and not use it during the wintertime. But if it's supplementing you during the summertime, that's the key point right there.
I remember I got hot one day, man, working out in the yard, and I grabbed that old water hose and I turned it on and it felt nice and cold and I went to take a drink and then it got to the water that was in the hot part of the hose and it put blisters on my lips. Yeah, boy, I said, oh no. So from then on, I knew the power of the sun on a hot water, on a hose, and always looked to see if the thing was in the shade.
Well, it's possible to retrofit your house right now to basically compensate for your doggone hot water heater, and even in the winter time there's methods by which you could actually ensure that that thing never freezes up, in the winter time.
I had a design that, and I don't mind letting people know, if you want to do it and build it yourself, go for it, man. And basically, you look at a thermos, man, and let's skip the joke about how did the thermos know whether to keep it hot or cold, bull crap, but the thing is, what's the problem with putting a vacuum on a wall? Well, okay, it's so many pounds per square inch. When you got a lot of square inches, that's a lot of pounds, and it's like, the walls will cave in. So if you made your walls where you could put a vacuum on it by putting some studs or some standoffs that keep it from collapsing ever so many inches and everything straight across, yes, you could put a vacuum on it. That house would be, and if you made them out of glass, which is not very thermal conductive, especially the borosilicate tempered glass, if you made standoffs between two layers of wall, you could put a vacuum on it, and your house would be as thermal as a thermos.
Yeah.
Why spend money to buy stuff to stuff in your wall when you can just suck it out of there? Just build the wall, right? Ready to take it. Heck, what do you need? You need one of them tire valves, okay? One of them tire valves. You can replace it if you need to. And once you put that pressure on that pin, you can sit there and you put a vacuum. It'll hold it. because that's pretty much what's on most of your, when you look on your car and you see where they suck the vacuum out of your lines, that's what it is. It's pretty much a tire valve. So it can be done cheaply. If I wanted to build a small shed, put an AC in that thing, I bet the AC, one of them energy efficient ones that shut off, I bet the AC wouldn't turn on but maybe once every hour for 5 minutes or something. Because you don't want it airtight. You gotta have room, you gotta have air to breathe, I'm sure. So that exchange right there, plus your body creating heat. I forget how much your body puts out. I remembered it was in BTUs, but over a time period, you wind up heating the place back up and the AC would come back on and take care of it. So it'd be very efficient.
Well, if you look at some of the things that happens whenever you get in your car and the heat isn't just right, you can actually build moisture up inside on your windshield just by breathing, you know. And so you have to have defrosters to dry that moisture out while you're driving down the road.
Yeah, and usually those defrosters use your air conditioning system to draw the moisture out of the air and then they add heat. Boy, that's some wattage.
But either way,
heated windows work better to keep the frost off your window.
I keep saying we got every single answer to every single problem out there. I mean, all just what we talked about today doesn't even scratch the surface of what you could actually do to make super efficient machines and super efficient houses. You know, if somebody wanted to design their house from start to finish, that's why I like that whole tiny house, because it'd be a good trial run to build a tiny house that, number one, the insulation on that thing was so incredible that if you wanted it cold in there, it'd stay cold in there.
Well, you don't hear my AC on here right now.
No.
And I'm in a tiny house, and what I put in the walls was that cellophane that they wrap pallets, the stuff on the pallets with, to keep them on the pallets. There's so many layers, and there's air between each of them. And I mean, it's as good as styrofoam. Might as well be an igloo cooler. The only place I don't have it is on my roof. But basically, I'm in the shade, so it doesn't affect it much. So once I do the roof, that's a big portion of it. And I get, I could use 4 inches of that. And then I'd have to get some real fine paneling or something just to hold it up there or something. And that'd finish this place off.
Yep. Well, I got all kinds of ideas. You got all kinds of ideas. And the whole deal is need to get everybody with these kinds of ideas in the same shop and do some work.
Yeah, well, I'm happy with my experiment. I'm happy with this experiment. It's actually proved out to be pretty good. I've enjoyed it. So, and actually kind of saved my butt. So, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled about it.
There's a lot of places out there where you can actually recycle stuff. I've been saving up old wine bottles for quite some time because I got a project that I want to work on with that. Using some of the things that we've talked about, you know, temperature differences and stuff. You could literally build a wall that would pull moisture out of the air and probably work a lot better in a humid climate. But nonetheless,
get your humidifier and collect it out of the air. Just got to make sure your air is filtered before it goes in there.
Yeah, well, basically what I'm wanting to do is something that, imagine building a wall where every single one of these bottles were on a 45 degree angle. And one side would always be in the shade. Alright, so you got the sun beating down on one side where you got a cool zone on the opposite side. Any atmosphere that makes it up in those bottles will basically start to generate moisture. You see what I'm saying?
So you'd have these with 45 degrees with the open end up?
No, open end down so that...
keep water out, right?
Yeah. Don't want to grab water from the rain or anything. Just want to any atmosphere that makes it up in those bottles will, because of the temperature difference. There's actually a survival thing out there, and you don't generate a lot of water. But if you take a piece of plastic and you put it over a cup, and you put it outside, in the sunlight, the heat beating on the top of that plastic and the temperature difference inside the atmosphere that was trapped inside that cup actually builds beads of water up on the inside the plastic.
Right.
Now, if you had a way to continuously refresh that atmosphere in there, like every, let's say every 30 seconds, a little valve opens up and lets in more air. Well, then it continuously will do the same process. You see what I mean?
Right.
As long as you got a temperature difference, you're going to build up condensation. You see that in all your air conditioning systems, whether it be in the car or even on the side of your house. When we run these big air conditioners out there on the side of my house, they generate a lot of water. You know, it's from the temperature difference from the inside and the out. You know, when those coils on the back, they get hot. And if it's those coils are hotter than the atmosphere around it, there's the temperature difference. That's how heat exchange works. You can do the same thing with your house. The attic is always getting hot. It's almost a closed-in area. It's got, you've got those regular standard house shingles on there, the, what they call them, composition shingles.
Composite?
Yeah, they got tar in them, and that tar builds up a lot of heat, and so if you go up there, and you can even feel the heat through your shoe. You can see the heat rising. That's why roofing during the summertime ain't very pleasant, because you got to be able to withstand a lot of heat. Otherwise, you get sick. But
yeah.
Nonetheless, that heat transfers into that attic. And since that attic's almost closed off, then it builds up a lot of heat in there. That's why you got to have the heat vents. Well, that heat is trying to rise and find a way out of there. If it can't rise, it will pressurize. And so you could guide that heat down into the basement of the house. You see what I mean?
Okay.
And then that heat will rise. You know, that's what happens. Cold air falls, heat rises. Well, the temperature difference between the heat being pumped into that basement where it's cool will actually generate moisture. So that process, you could actually turn your house into a thermal heat exchanger to where just the sunlight alone will do your heating or cooling. You see what I mean?
Yep. I thought about a vertical axis wind turbine to a compressor.
Well,
and releasing the air through a small orifice down. It's like Boomer was saying, his brother operated the crane, and it gets real hot in that crane because you're on top of that engine and you're closed in. You know, he made a, and they had compressors in the thing already. He just took one of the airlines and ran it in there and put a small orifice on the back and had it blowing at the back of his head, and every like 3 or 4 minutes he'd hear the air, the frequency of the air going through the orifice change a little bit, and then it would spit a little bead of ice at the back of his head. So it gets pretty cold.
Also, remember those old window style heaters that you put in your window made out of glass and some cans and stuff like that?
Window style heaters?
Yeah, you make these boxes that will fit in your window, and it's got a piece of glass on the outside, and it's got cans that are all spray painted black.
Oh yeah. The solar pop can heaters.
Yeah,
right.
you don't even need no fan, because it will actually, the temperature difference will create enough turbulence to cause that heat inside that box to escape out into, because the heat's going to pressurize in there, heat expands, and so the hotter it gets inside there, that energy's got to go somewhere. It'll go into your room. So you don't
convection,
even need a fan.
Convection currents.
Yeah. Well, if you go watch the Free Thinker video, there's a box that was made out of a couple of heaters with glass doors, and it has a dryer hose that goes up inside that other box that goes up underneath that little turbine. So when that thing gets hot inside that box, that heat's then transferred up into the other box, adding to the heat inside there and causing the little turbine to turn.
You know, a lot of people think you got to save a bunch of can and make a bunch of tubes, do all that fancy assembly. You really don't.
You don't.
You just, All you need is two pieces of glass, one to keep the inner piece. You know, you put one piece of glass on there and the wind blows off. You got the inside painted black and it's collecting heat, but basically that glass is hot because of the heat inside there and the wind blows and takes your heat away. Put a little space in the second glass there. Now you've got something that, that collects heat and holds it, because you do have one thermal barrier. And that's all you need. You don't need those cans. Just spray paint that sucker flat black and let the sun hit it.
A long time ago, they used to have these torture devices that they called hot boxes. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, yeah.
Well, essentially, they would just release just enough heat to keep you alive in there, but you'd be miserable in there. And the same thing, if you ever get up inside of an attic during the summertime.
Some people actually got baked.
Yeah. And also, you know, some people use that same concept for what would have normally been a torture device to make basically like saunas, you know. It gets hot in there, all you gotta do is pour some water down inside the deal and that would build up a steam inside there, you know. But I only pointed that out because you don't need to spray paint the cans like you're talking about, you know. You're right. And
just
so,
a box, two layers of glass.
Yeah.
Outlet.
You could build a box that was equivalent of like the roof on your attic, and that would put enough heat inside there to do the same job. So there's simple methods. Heck, if you wanted to build you a building, an outbuilding on the outside of your house, and then have that pumped in through the ground on one side or direct in on the other, and all you had to do was to change the flow was to move a flap. During the summertime, that heat would build up moisture as it went under the ground and create a cooling effect inside your house. And during the wintertime, it'd do just the opposite. It'd blow the heat directly into your house. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you could build an outside air conditioner that way. You know, just using the temperature difference. And that wouldn't require any electricity.
That's right. A lot of times, you know, if you sit there and you say, well, gosh, I can't afford this, I can't afford that, and you find a cheaper way to do it, a lot of times it's actually more efficient.
I think
if you can build more of them because you don't have to do as much work or collect more of them, guess what? It's you can have more of them, which means, you know, you didn't spend any money. It was all free. You didn't have to collect up a bunch of cans, in other words. Let's put it this way. On the side of the road, I got me an edger, okay, one of them gasoline edgers. Well, I cleaned the car best I could, and the sucker still did not want to run. So I got me a plastic bottle, and I stuffed it. Didn't stuff it, but I put some T-shirt in there. And you wet the T-shirt, and if you wet it too much, you're gonna have to pull it a little while, but. I tell you what, long enough to do one whole edge, just a couple spoons of gas and everything will sit there and make vapor. You make a vapor carb, and the air goes through the T-shirt, and it runs good. When it starts to run a little rough, you drop another spoon of gas up on it, or through a squeeze bottle, just kind of squeeze it up in the end, and it'll rev back up and just keep going. You could make an automatic drip thing if you wanted to or something, but, you know, I just had a little squirt bottle. I'd spray it into the end of the bottle, which is wide open, and it also served as an air cleaner. And, of course, it wasted some gas, but it's more efficient because it's a vapor carb. But you wasted some gas because there's always, when it gets to, when it gets really lean on the gas, there's always some gas left in there that'll evaporate when you're done. But you know what? Heck, I used that edger. I used it about once a week, and I used it all summer last summer.
Thomas threw a deal in there. He said, or beef jerky and dried fruits and vegetables. See, there's another thing you can use that process for.
Really?
Dehydrating food for, you know, future use.
Right. I get you.
So you could get. You can get this house to do a lot of work for you.
Yep.
So,
there's a cheap way to do a lot of things, man.
What do you say we take a music break and refresh our coffee and stuff?
Good morning, Thomas. Sounds great to me.
All right, folks, you're listening to Mad Science. I'm throwing Freebird in there again. It's a 9-minute song. That'll be enough time to get coffee, don't you think?
Sounds good to me.
I don't have a wide selection on music, but...
crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911. We'll be right back.
name is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, could you describe the ruckus, sir? All right, so we've been talking about efficiency and stuff like that, how we could actually engineer machines to literally be super efficient. And in the process of that, I'm sitting here designing things in my head, the redneck version of how we could actually build systems that would supplement the energy for your hot water heating system that you could put outside during the summertime would keep your element or your thermostat from ever even kicking on. That's one way to do it. And also that the composting heat you could probably combine into it and generate some heat that even during the winter time while the stuff was still rotten, that it would also generate heat and at the very least keep the tank from freezing up in the winter time, but just keep it up to above freezing it, whatever. So there's all kinds of potential there. And if you could keep your hot water heater from ever kicking on, then that means the less electricity you'd have to pay for. And so I'm thinking we could actually build small versions using things that already existed. An old hot water heater for the storage portion of it, and use thermal siphoning to actually take the temperature between the cool and the hot to actually circulate without any kind of electric water pump necessary, using gravity and things like that. And when the water pressure got hot enough in there, you could actually use steam. So, there's all kinds of different potentials there using just the basic science and basic laws of physics of how things function. So if somebody paid attention in science class and had a little bit of ingenuity and maybe some mechanical skills or whatever, you could literally go to the scrap heap and design a system such as what we're talking about. So when things are composing, you wouldn't necessarily want them up against something that was metal because you cause the metal to rot, but there are materials such as rubber that you could put in between there. Just like in every single hot water heater, they actually have a sacrificial piece of metal inside there. In some old hot water heaters, it'll have magnesium in there. And in the country, if you got water that stinks when it comes out, it's because there's like little microbes, bacteria inside there that's interacting with that magnesium.
And it's sulfur and arsenic.
Yeah, it's producing a stinky gas. And so you can bypass that by putting a different type of metal in there, like titanium, with a little bit of a charge to it, will actually keep your water from stinking, even if you live out in the country. So all of these things taken in consideration with each other, and all the waste that your house would normally produce now becomes a plus because you're either using it for fuel or composting. If you have a septic system, you are producing methane. That methane could actually be pressurized and stored somewhere. It's stored energy. Basically, turning your entire house into a self-efficient piece of machinery, a heat engine, a focused heat engine. When, in the future, if what I see coming around, you won't be calling them internal combustion engines anymore. You'll be calling them focused heat engines. Because it'll take whatever energy that you put into it and focus it to do the job that you want in the most efficient manner possible, according to science. So, basically, you'd have an engine that would be, something that's going to last, for one. And you'd have one that would use a whole lot less fuel than your average internal combustion engine, and you would pull the energy that you want off of there in the most efficient manner possible, using all of what we know about centrifugal force and leverage and gear ratios and such. It's unlimited, buddy, what we could actually do if we really seriously wanted to put our minds to it. The future's got to get here sooner or later. And
I actually have a friend who you know, he lives out there amongst the trees, and he's one of them tree worshippers, and goes out there and does them rituals, but, you know, I know he's a different religion and all that stuff. But he lives totally off the grid. And he's got a methane digester that provides the methane gas to burn to heat his trailer. Now, none of that gas goes into the trailer. It's exchanged before it goes into the trailer.
Yeah.
But it is enough to heat his place, his trailer. You know, trailers are hard to heat, but they're small. So, but it's enough to do his cooking and heat his place. And all he does is just take dead grass and different things, and he's got a whole list of how many BTUs you get out of so many pounds of like grass or barley or tomatoes or whatever that you got composting and rotting, and all that goes back out into the garden. Everything is used.
Yeah, and you could actually, because propane, butane, and methane are gases that if you pressurize and expand rapidly, you can build your own air conditioner. Imagine if you, instead of putting an electric motor on or generator head on a windmill, you put an air pump. And the air pump, its only job is to pressurize the methane into a cylinder that in turn will go into an expansion chamber rapidly and produce air conditioning. So you could build an air conditioner that ran off the wind.
Right. As long as you have no oxygen in there, you're not going to get that diesel effect.
Yeah.
Where it goes boom. So you just, as long as you're steadily putting some in there for any leaks or anything like that, it shouldn't be a problem.
You can replace the compressor pump from any existing air conditioner, so you could modify the in any existing air conditioner to, when the wind is out, it's still hot outside and it's windy outside, but when the wind is out, instead of having the pump air compressor pump kick on to create the pressure, you have the wind actually creating the pressure inside there. So you see
these people that throw a lit match in the gas tank and it doesn't blow up. Well, there's still, you know, you leave that cap off there long enough, get enough oxygen in there, the air mixture actually does become volatile. If they open it and throw it in there right away, that's one thing. But, you know, when they leave it open for a little bit and everybody's talking around, you go throw another one in there, next thing you know, blew everybody up. So keep, without the oxygen, it's not volatile. So just about anything can be...
Imagine a system like this, buddy. You got a septic tank that would produce methane, and it doesn't take a lot of gas to pressurize in order to be able to do this, and you can actually recirculate the same gas right back down into the same septic tank,
right?
Because they're normally vented anyway. But imagine you take your windmill, and it's got a air pump on there that basically, as it's coming down the line, the air pressure comes down the line, it sucks in methane from your septic tank, runs it into a pressure chamber that pressurizes it. When the pressure reaches a certain amount, the pressure relief valve will open up, spraying the methane into an expansion chamber rapidly, and you can take cool air off of that right there. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So
you can use regular air, but it's just not as efficient as other things that expand and contract more.
Yeah. Excuse me. Gases like butane, propane, if you've ever filled up a cigarette lighter or something with a little can of butane, if it sprays out the side, you'll notice how that doggone thing gets cold. And even carbon dioxide, same thing. Spray it out, it gets cold because it's that rapid expansion that produces the cooling effect.
And right. I used to love running when I was working at the sign company. I used to love everybody wanted the drills that were the electric drills and stuff because they were easy to move around and stuff. Shoot, no, it was hot in that doggone warehouse, hotter than it was outside in the summer. Shoot, I just kept my mouth shut and I'd grab that I'll tell you what, I've had it where that pneumatic drill got so cold it was hard to handle and you had to swap hands. So, yeah, I love that cold air blasting at me.
Yeah, you could produce an air conditioner using, like, bread and sugar and water and basically making you a deal that would produce carbon dioxide. And mm-hmm. carbon dioxide will pressurize. It'll pressurize itself if it's a completely sealed container. And so basically you could design the equivalence of an air wind turbine that would take this off of the carbon dioxide out of this, pressurize it into a tank, allow for rapid expansion into an expansion chamber, and build an AC. I don't understand why the alternative energy community hasn't jumped on that to make a windmill that was an air conditioner instead of a generator.
It's not that hard. See, you've got your horizontal axis wind turbines and everything. And, you know, if you put a compressor up on that, then, you know, the wind changes direction. And you got to make sure, you know, you got to have one of them bittens that'll sit there and turn, you know, and adjust, you know. But those wear out and then they leak and, you know, it's a pain in the butt and you got to go up the tower. But if you built a vertical axis wind turbine, your lines wouldn't move. And when the air is going up, it gets a chance to, you know, it basically, I mean, once it's compressed and on its way down the line, from the top of the tower where you got your vertical axis wind turbine, all that compressed air is hot.
Yeah.
Bleeds off in the line. And if you just took that other end and had it come inside and just put it through the orifice, seeing it's nothing but air, you can just blow that straight in.
Yeah.
And that air will be cold.
You could put the equivalence of a gearbox up there on that windmill and have that gearbox running a shaft straight down and having that running a compressor on the ground, and you could also use the heat off the compressor head itself to literally run like Peltier elements and stuff, you know, to get some
right.
thermoelectrics off of it. Or, you know, actually use the heat off of the compressor to, you know, heat water up. There's all kinds of different possibilities. You know, it just depends on how far you want to take them. But if you could...
Oh, you're saying insulate the line coming down the pole.
Yeah.
Or down the tower and then run it through some copper tube inside your hot water tank, which is insulated, and then have it come out, then go inside. And since it's been cooled off, then when it expands, it gets really cold.
Yeah.
It'll basically... Yeah, collect all that heat you would have bled off the line up there.
You could also, if you really wanted to get technical about it, you could also put the copper tubing right inside a rubber hose that you could heat water, you know, with the copper tubing.
Right, you know, inside the hose, right.
And the sunlight outside. So, it's not about that we don't have enough energy, it's about we're not using it efficiently enough. That's what the whole key's been all along. It's how we're using the energy. It's how we're taking the energy off the generator head or how we're generating steam. You know, they talk about all this carbon emissions stuff. There ain't no reason for carbon emissions if you do it right. And I'm not even worried about carbon emissions. That doesn't bother me a bit.
You know, they send people into the United States and they give them free, they put them on welfare and they give them more money than the average person makes. Oh, mainly because they don't want these people under the poverty level. But you know that 80% of the Americans, or pretty much anywhere, 80% of the people are living in the poverty level as what for what they claim is poverty. And I believe that because I make a lot less than people get for their Social Security and all that stuff. So here's the deal, man. If a man can't get shoes, he can't get a job, and he can't get a job because he ain't got no shoes. And the people are caught in that little rat trap. So getting these things underway and installed and put up and stuff like that costs money. But that's what I was saying before. There's a lot of things you can do with just what you find off the side of the road and things like that to go ahead and just get started on it and get things done. Just you know, if you get an extra $50, go down and get you one of them doggone thick black rubber hoses. See, people buy garden hoses, and they're going to spend $25 on this thing. Next year, they've got to buy another one because this one had a kink in it, and it cracked, and it broke, and it leaks. I've got one of them black hoses that I bought for $50, and I've had it for 7 years. It does not leak. That's nice. You run over the stupid thing. They're tough. They last. Just that little, you know why people buy these vinyl windows? Because they think they can't afford the expensive ones. But you get to go to a rich man's house, and you're going to find out he's got them rich ones. You know why he's rich? Because he don't like buying things every year.
Yeah.
He'd rather buy it once. So sometimes if you sit there and you think about how long something's going to last and what you can do with it, you ever take a drink off one of them regular garden hoses? The water tastes like the plastic.
Yeah, well,
The $50 hose is drinking water safe. The water tastes great. So if you put that into the mixture, man, there's a lot of ways that you can buy things and spend the money that you normally spend, save money, and come out with much better quality. And just by doing that, you can do a lot to get yourself on your feet. And it's more cost effective.
A lot of the things that we're talking about, you can get recycled. You know, people throw stuff away because they make things to break down. Most generally, when they break down, it's something ridiculously simple. It's an electrical part in there, or some little mechanical failure that actually could be repurposed or rebuilt or whatever.
Exactly. A guy come by here the other day says, "I need a crowbar, man, or one of them shovels because I'm tearing off the roofing on the house and I got to take the plywood off." I said, "Well, you know what? You got to get rid of that plywood and it's got nails in it." I said, "Tell you what, man. I said, I'll loan you the tools you need. You bring me all of that plywood on the roof ain't bad. Bring me back the good ones that aren't falling apart. Now I don't care if part of it's chipped or this or that." I said, "Bring me back the plywood and let you use the tools."
Cool.
He says, "Great. That way I don't have to pay to get rid of it." I said, "That's right." I'm getting free plywood. That's exactly it. You go down and try to buy plywood. You used to be able to buy a sheet of plywood for $8.50. Now, plywood's $35-40.
Yeah.
And if you want the OSB, which is nothing but chips of wood all glued together, and if it gets wet, you fall through. now that stuff's running $10-12. Now, come on, man.
Well,
they said it was better, so it was more expensive than regular plywood because it was harder and all that other stuff. But then people with their real life experience found out it wasn't worth nothing. But the price of plywood went up.
You hit another key too. There's also industries out there that they got to pay to get rid of a lot of stuff, and they'd be more than happy to give stuff to you just to get rid of it.
Someone brought me three loads worth of stuff that he'd have paid more to take and get rid of at the landfills and dumps and recycling centers. He'd have paid more to get rid of it than the gas it would to bring it to me.
You know that
I've got like 42x4s out here that I had to just clean the nails out of, and you know he just dropped it off.
You know that they said that the Chinese, when they bring giant shipping containers over here, that it costs more for them to take them back, and so they leave them over here, and they'll give you those things just to get rid of them? The only expense you got is
moving it? It used to be that way until the price of steel and scrap went up. Now the price of steel and scrap is going to go down, then because they've got all they can use and they don't need no more. That might become a reality again, where you can get that shipping container by just going by and picking it up. So keep your eyeballs peeled.
Yep. Well, either way, there's a whole lot of other industries out there that have a lot of waste. You know, the environmentalists always talk about how you gotta, you know, become more sustainable. If you took all the restaurants in the entire United States and instead of using their garbage going to the dump, if you took that same garbage and you made machinery out there that would separate materials, you could compost it all down, generate heat for thermoelectrics, and you know, just all kinds of stuff, even fertilizer. You know, there's never, when we say waste, there's never any waste. As far as any trash, all that trash could be recycled. there's a company, like I said on a prior show, there's a company down here that has figured out how to make money off their trash, off your trash. Essentially, they charge you to take it away, then they recycle it and reuse it, and they use the everything in that in the trash that you send off gets used. It gets used for machinery on their they make fuel out of it. They make electricity with it. They recycle the plastics, the glass, the metal.
They had a project out there at Langley, NASA, which was the top, covered pretty much a third of the top part of Langley Air Force Base on the upper left, or shall I say the northwest corner of it. So NASA had this one plant, and all of the trash in Pocosin and half of Hampton and one other town went there first. They went through the recycle. They made all the electricity for Langley Air Force Base and NASA, even them giant, huge wind tunnels. And they basically took the rest of it and the other plastics and stuff that they didn't burn and recycled that and made other products with it. So every bit of it got used. So that's an example there.
Well,
enough deal. If you need one of them 350-gallon water totes, man, you're going to pay like $500-$600 for one. If you go by your meat packing plant, guess what? Every day they have to spray down all that stainless steel wall and floor and squeegee and clean it all out, and they've got food safe cleansers and sanitizers that come in them 350-gallon totes. And after they get done using, all you got to do is rinse them out. Now you could take them suckers and sell them for $75 and $100 every time you get one from them. All you got to do is rinse them out, and they're food grade safe because they wouldn't be able to use them in a food meat packing plant. So if you know where there's a meat packing plant close to you, go by there and check them out if you want one.
All right.
I'll let you have them.
I'm posting a link in the chat room to a website called SkyOceanRescue.com. And I'm asking for people out there listening into this show to try to get a hold of these people. I've made an attempt to get a hold of these people. And basically, I watched the documentaries where I got this doggone website from about plastic bottles that are washing up on what they would call paradise beaches and stuff. And it just keeps coming and coming and coming, and I'm sitting here thinking, these guys and gals, they're all upset about it because it's destroying the environment, but I'm sitting there looking at it like, man, if I lived on that beach, I'd turn that trash into treasure, literally. You know, they had been donated a machine that smashes up glass, and so they've been using some of that glass for different things. Imagine if we designed a machine that would literally not only separate glass and metals and plastics, and you just put all the stuff in the same chute, and it goes down there and grinds it all up, and depending on its size or magnetic qualities or whatever, it would completely separate it all into different containers that you could then in turn use this to recycle into all kinds of products. They could turn that into a doggone economy. While everybody else is trying to trash the joint, they could turn around and use it as a plus. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking at the website. That's pretty interesting.
See if you can get somebody on that website to talk to me, and I will give them some ideas that they could use that where that would be normally a mess. Now, granted, there's a lot of plastic bottles because they say it just keeps on coming and coming, and just no matter how much they clean it up, it just keeps showing up, and it's all over through the ocean. Even somebody had mentioned at one point there's like an island of it floating around out there. Right? Well, see if you can find
some. I haven't seen a picture of that. I'd like a picture of that. If anybody knows where there's a picture of that island, I want to see it.
Well, I'd love to see it too. But see if you can find somebody on there who'd be willing to come on this show and hear me out, man. Because I honestly believe that even though it's a pain in the neck that all that trash is floating up there, They could literally turn that into building supplies and energy, and they could turn it into a literal economy if they wanted to. It's coming whether they like it or not. And until you get people to design industry differently, I mean, there's a solution there that you can still, somebody's still got to pick the trash up. Heck, we could design a machine that would pick the doggone trash up for that matter. But we're, you know, as normally an environmental disaster could be turned into a positive and still clean up the environment. You see what I mean?
They got a Facebook page as well, so.
Well, throw a link to their Facebook page in there. I think I've already joined on that page. I don't know if I did or not, but I should double check, but I thought I did. Anyway, I put a note somewhere for them, but you know, trying to get a hold of people is like trying to pull teeth, man. It's nuts. Anyway, I would love to talk to the people in charge of that website and give them some ideas for solutions. I mean, the glass bottles that people grab up and recycle, if you had the right machine put together, you could actually use the trash to generate the heat that would take to melt this glass into blocks, and you could turn them blocks into a sellable product. Imagine.
That'd be pretty neat to have a glass house, man. You can clean your house with Windex.
Yeah. But you could also turn that glass into, decorative landscaping and stuff. You know, if you didn't care what color it was and it had swirled different colors of glass or whatever, you could just put all the glass into one deal and turn around and make, make door stoppers with them. paperweights and all kinds. It'd be unlimited what you could use that. If you had an unlimited resource of glass and plastic coming your way.
Look at old Dan Ross. He takes his Fresnel lenses, put on his welding goggles, and he takes the glass and he turns it into obsidian and sells it to jewelers.
See?
Yep.
There's another potential deal. But I'd love to talk to these folks. I'd love to have a Skype conversation with them or live stream or a radio show or something and just sit there and troubleshoot all kinds of ways. Because, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. You could literally design a tractor to go down the beach and comb the beach for you. And it'd pick up the sand and drop the sand and pick up the trash and load the trash. What do you think a combine does? You know? How do you think they get the corn out of the field? It doesn't take everything with it. It basically knocks the corn off and throws it in the deal, or the beans, or whatever. Depending on what size of blades they got. You could put combs that would comb that beach perfectly clean, pick up anything, any trash, you know?
Yep.
And, basically turn what would have normally been a negative into a positive and, you know, help to recycle and keep the planet clean. You could actually do the same thing in the ocean if you wanted to. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. There's engineering that could be done to where we could go around in a boat and literally pick up trash until, you know, the thing's full. There's all kinds of deals, man. Especially if the bottles are floating. Along and scoop them up.
This idea of just get a barge and start scooping up the plastic bottles out there and either melt it and make you a city out there, or just keep taking the plastic and turning it into petroleum, stay out there for a while, and then take a smaller boat and take the petroleum to shore and sell it, and you can live off it as long as people keep throwing the stuff out there.
Yeah.
People don't realize how it actually gets out there. I mean, you like your little plastic water bottle. That's like a balloon. You know, it doesn't take much rain to float a balloon, because that plastic bottle is real thin and light, and it winds up going down, and it makes it to the stream, and it goes out there. And I'm saying 80% of the plastic winds up on shores in other countries, all the way to Ireland and stuff from here. Yeah. So,
check this out. Tell me if this doesn't sound like a crazy idea. Somebody going to say, well, It costs too much energy to do that. It wouldn't be financially feasible. Ah, hockahooey. You got an aluminum can, right? And at every single house has this nifty little toy. You put the aluminum can in there, it automatically smashes it. A heater heats the doggone thing, melts the aluminum, drains it down into a pre-existing mold that then in turn, when it's melted down, pops out a token out the other end, you know. Now you got this little token that says recycled coin. All right, money. All right. Each one of those coins now has value because aluminum has value. And they want to be able to, it's pure aluminum now. Excuse me. And so now you could use these as money. You see what I mean?
Plastic money.
Well, even plastic. You could do the same thing with plastic. These chips, would they actually have money because that amount of plastic has some sort of value. Even if it's only in the fraction of the cent, it still has value because now it's recycled plastic that could be ground down and turned into a product. And you get so many of these, a dollar's worth of them, say, might be a whole trash bag full. I don't know. But you gather these things up. Hey, you got these machines that will literally take whatever material you put in there and put it down into a little token, plastic, paper, whatever, you know. And yeah, you got a different kind of economy. You got a recycle economy that you can trade these for actual products. And people who want, let's say I got me aluminum coin, right? And I need aluminum paperweight. It takes me so many aluminum coins to equal up to the weight of that paperweight. And so I can take my aluminum coins that I've collected from recycling my cans and putting them into tokens. I can take them over there and buy this nifty looking bird paperweight that weighs the equivalence of each of these coins.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Why not?
Same thing with plastic.
Yep. Elements hold a value, man.
Yeah. If I want a plastic fly swatter, it might take me 50 tokens to buy this plastic fly swatter that's also made out of the same recycled stuff. And it's right. An economy that would never go bad because you would always have the product. You'd have the fly swatter or you'd have the coin. The coin could be made into anything.
Did you ever have a lighter that wouldn't, you know, You held, somebody held it too long or something like that, maybe at a concert trying to use it as a light. Next thing you know, the thing's on fire and you just can't turn it off and it's gonna sit there and burn. Next thing it goes woof and the propane comes out of it, butane comes out of it, and that sucker continues to burn and it stinks and it burns and it burns and it burns. Why? Because it's made of petroleum. I used to take my 2-liter bottles when I was done. I'd put my foot on it and loosen the cap until it lost its air, and I'd mash that sucker completely fat and then close the top on it, and it would stay flat because it's on a vacuum. Now what I'd do, I'd save these things up, and every night in the wintertime you gotta light my wood stove. One on the bottom, one on the top. The cool thing about the one on the top, it melts. And it goes all over the log, and it stays, and it burns forever. Sooner, it's a sure light, man. It's as good as putting gas on it, except it doesn't go boof. So, yeah, it's another way of using petroleum, and it lit my fire every night. So that's a good use for the 2 liters, and maybe Gatorade bottles and stuff.
Well, I think I just coined a new phrase. Element. How do you spell elemental?
Let's see, E-L-E mental, yeah.
Alright, so we're going to call it elemental economy. I spelt that wrong too. I'm trying to put it into Google because you know how Google likes to spell things for you.
You be elemental, man.
Huh. Alright, so basically elemental economy would mean that we would take whatever elements that we like, plastic, paper, or whatever, and we'd build tokens out of them. And these tokens could be saved up for its equivalence in weight. So now you have a value. And, you know, probably somebody will put some sort of, you know, like when you buy a product from Walmart, it's a 300% markup. So somebody will try to charge you more than the weight of it. And so you just go buy from somebody who'll charge you less.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, with this particular idea, aluminum cans be smashed down into a doggone token that in turn you can take that token and it has a value, put it in your own recycled piggy bank, and when you want to buy something that's made of that element, all you do is give them the weight of it and maybe some for their services or whatever. See?
Yeah.
So if it only takes 50 to equal the weight of whatever product you want, you might give them, let's say, 75. That gives them some buying power for their effort. How's that sound?
Sounds cool. Be nice to have them hold and just make poker chips.
Yeah.
Sell them bad boys. They'd be worth more than trying to make a coin out of them.
So there you go, man. There's an idea. There's a solution on how we can turn trash into treasure. My grandpa used to say that one man's trash is another man's treasure, and we could actually turn trash into an economy, you know, a second economy. You know, you got your regular economy that they're always saying is going to collapse and all that kind of stuff. Well, how what a better way to clean up the planet than to turn your trash into tokens that now have monetary value as far as you can exchange them for other recycled materials that you need.
Do you know how much a gas tank for a weed eater cost?
Uh-uh.
About a third of the price of the stupid weed eater. So, add the old weed eater. I forget what company it was, but they're out of business. So you don't get that gas tank anymore. Unless it's an old used one. Who needs an old used one? It's going to crack in a year.
Yeah.
So, I took a 2-liter bottle, and I put some water in it. I put it in the microwave, and it started shrinking. I roll it over, and I let the pressure off on it. It started shrinking and getting smaller. And then when it got down to a certain size, what I did, I stuck it inside a piece of PVC with a little clamp on the side of it to where it would basically match where it clamps onto the weed eater. You know what? That thing looked pretty cool on there. And I had the top bent up where the cap would go on there, and came out pretty good. And then I stuck a soldering iron into the side and put a hole there and heated up another piece of plastic that had the hose already on it and had it sticking out there. I heated up. I threw a bunch of plastic on it. You know what? That gas tank is still on that weed eater, and it's been 3 years. And I made that sucker. It's a nice custom one.
Hey, I just thought of something.
Yeah.
And we're almost down to the end of the show. But either way, Stephen said it sounds the same as resource-based economy that the Venus Project is espousing. Now, the difference, I think, would be that we're actually going to produce a coin out of the particular material. And it doesn't matter if somebody counterfeits that coin, because it'd be still the same material.
Yeah, for it.
Yeah,
it's only worth the price of the material.
Yeah, so it's only worth the price of the material. So there you go, man. There's a doggone solution. I think maybe we could try to do that. You know, take a CNC mill or something like that, and we'll build a mold that will, maybe you don't even have to melt the metal. Maybe you can use pressure to squish it all flat and then squeeze it into a token. They used to do that with pennies. Remember those machines? You put a penny in there and it'll run through and it'll print out a design like a Roadrunner on the penny?
Yep.
Yeah, so we could come up with an idea like that to do the same thing with materials. You know, you put a plastic bottle in there, and it'll literally run it around until it finally mushes it into almost liquid, and then squeeze it into a mold, and there you go. Now you got a doggone token.
Yeah, they've got this cutter. You kind of put it on a pole, and then you just cut the bottom off of your 2-liter bottle, and you set it on there, and you give it a little turn, and then you grab the end, this little fine sliver, and you pull it, and the bottle just keeps on turning around and around and around and around. It makes this kind of plastic rope for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can take a 2-liter bottle and get like 20-something feet, 25 or 30 feet out of a doggone 2-liter bottle. And so they're thinking about that. Guy's got a deal on that. And then there's the deal, like Thomas says, you can take them bottles and turn them into that fiber for the 3D printing.
Yep. That, I've been saving bottle caps for just such a reason, because if you got a you built a grinding system that would grind them bottle caps down into, you know, like powder, where you could turn around and then be able to heat it easier. You know, don't necessarily have to grind it down. You could still melt them the way they are and turn it into filament for your 3D printers.
Oh, that wouldn't be nothing. Here's what you do. Here's what you do there, she says. This is super simple. You take 2x4 and you take the frame, you know, the plate on your skill saw?
Yeah.
That flat plate? Alright. You sit there and you make 2x4 box kind of, to where your skill saw would sit down there, and then you put a piece of wood on the bottom. Don't even cut a slit in it. And then you make another box on the bottom. And you make it kind of thin there, close to where the blade's going to come down. And just have it where it feeds them in there, and just keeps on feeding in there. What you do is you take your skill saw and you start setting it down in the box, and it'll cut its own hole. Nothing will come out. It'll only be the width of the blade, custom perfect. And that skill saw blade will cut them suckers up real good. You keep on sending it through until you get the right grain of what you want.
Cool.
That is an easy, a really easy way.
Well, you could also probably take multiples of those blades, put them on a single shaft, and run a little electric motor to grind them up that way as well.
Right.
But either way, you know, like I said, where there's a wheel, there's a way. They say necessity is the mother of invention, and so somebody, do me a favor, get a hold of that doggone website, Sky Ocean Rescue, and point them in my direction. Tell them I want to talk to them, and I'll tell them, show them how they can turn that trash into treasure and still be able to clean up that, what do they call, what is the word I just said earlier about... doggone paradise. Turn their beaches back into a paradise. And for, you know, the average household, it would give you an incentive to be able to have these machines, and somebody who wanted to build these machines could actually sell them the same way you'd sell a dishwasher or a, things that mix your drink, man, a blender. Blenders, toasters.
I got paradise hanging from my mirror.
Yeah, paradise hanging from your mirror.
Fuzzy.
Paradise, I lost all my money with a pair of dice.
My teacup, yeah.
We told you it was a mad science show, so you're liable to hear anything.
Along with my fuzzy, with my little fuzzy dingle balls hanging across there, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we could turn all the world's trash into usable items. You know, everybody needs a fly swatter, because flies are obnoxious.
Oh, I need one. Boy, I need one.
And there's so many different things that we could actually do using... if we used our resources that we have available to us in such an efficient manner, there wouldn't be no such thing as a dump anymore. There wouldn't be no waste products. You know, you wouldn't even waste the food that came off your plate that you didn't want to eat. It would be reused to do things with, you know. You turn it into biofuels or, all kinds of stuff. You'd be surprised. When you burn a piece of firewood, you don't... the firewood never really goes away. It changes the shape and physics. It turns into ash. That ash can be, there's at least 10 different products. One of them included is a lye soap that you can make with wood ash. The soot that goes up the chimney is another fuel. You gotta get you some things to clean the creosote out of your doggone chimney. Otherwise you risk another fire that you don't want.
I got a lot of ash from my wood stove, but Oh, it takes a lot of doggone soap to get that stuff off you. But you say you make soap with that.
Yeah, you make lye soap with it. There's Google it up. There's ten different products that I know of that you can make with wood ash.
So I could take the wood ash to make me some soap to wash the wood ash off of me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you think you're wasting stuff, and it usually goes in a pile, and now you got this pile of waste that you don't want, and you don't know what to do with it. But if you knew how to recycle it, every single thing that you got can be reused. All the clothing, all the materials, all the plastic, even the fuel waste coming out of your deal. I still want to see somebody turn around and take all the exhaust off of a Briggs & Stratton engine and run a second Briggs & Stratton engine in line with itself off the exhaust fumes of the other. And see how many times you can do that in a row.
My ash from my wood stove usually goes in my compost pile. Because all your plants are carbon-based life forms. And I tell you what, anything south of a coal plant grows really fast. Because that's the way the wind normally hits it.
If you took the exhaust off of a Briggs & Stratton engine and ran it in through a bubbler system like you would do a wood gasifier, and
right.
take the gas off of the top of that and run another engine with it, you just made that a whole lot more efficient. Now you're just raised your efficiency of how much power you're going to get out of the fuel you use. And how many times you could do this in a row, it'd be crazy. So, excuse me. All this talking drying my throat out. I'm gonna get some coffee.
Nice talking to you.
Anyway, where there's a will, there's a way. If somebody can get me in contact with that skyoceanrescue.com, I'll give them some ideas and see where we go with that. And anybody else out there interested, send some people over to ShazizRadio.com on the Mad Science Show on Saturdays, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central. And send them there on Sundays for the Knights of the Round Table, 8 a.m., 11 a.m. Central. Share a podcast that you're interested in. Cut and chop it. Put it on your network or whatever you want to do. Send somebody over to ask some questions. We got all kinds of ideas. We may not always be right, but we can't always be wrong. That's a fact. And if anything works out and benefits and helps clean up the planet, then isn't that what everybody wanted to begin with? You know, reduce the carbon emissions, reduce how many trees you gotta cut down. Why cut down trees if you can use hemp? They make a lot of products. 50,000 is what I heard on hemp products. So it's unlimited.
If I get a hold of them guys, I'll send them your phone number, and if it seems like they aren't listening to you and about ready to hang up, put your wife on there. She'll get them.
All right, we'll do that.
Yeah.
Yep. Get them in contact with me if you can.
I've
tried, but so far I'm not very successful. But either way, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show, folks. For every single problem out there, there is a solution. No ifs, ands, or buts. Bring some people to listen to what we got to say, and when people want to get together and network with one another, we can utilize all our resources in the most efficient manner, and we can turn this world around. It's possible. You just got to want it bad enough. So with that said, you've been listening to Mad Science. Peace and love, everybody. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.